Welcome to the Inclusive Education Project. I'm Vicki Brett.
I'm Amanda Salohi. We're two civil rights lawyers on a mission to change the conversation about education, civil rights, and modern activism.
Each week, we're going to explore new topics, which are going to educate and empower others.
And give them a platform to enact change in education and level the playing field. Welcome back, friends.
Hello. It's going to be a solo one.
Just us. You know, we had this topic kind of pop up in a couple of our cases more recently. It feels like I just got a couple things at the same time with this issue. And so we thought it was important because we haven't really touched on it too much. And I think it's something that is really under-identified or under-supported in IEPs. And so that topic is ELL designation, or English language learner. I think so often we see in IEPs, we see a student is designated as ELL, but nothing comes of it. And so today we want to really touch on, like, when should a child be designated as an English language learner? And where do we go from there? Like, what are the district's obligations for that child based on that designation?
Right. And there are a lot of different programs to improve, like, English language skills for these learners. Yeah. So, you know, this is one of those areas where there's overlap and there are different things that can happen. And just because you're ELL and have an IEP doesn't mean that you do X, Y, and Z, right? And I think that that's why, and you and I kind of have had different experiences where it will say ELL and the child was proficient from, like, the get-go. And I'll talk about how that is determined. And the parent is trying to get off that designation, but because they are of a certain ethnicity, it just, like, stays on there. Whereas in your situation, it was the opposite, where, well, like, they just didn't do anything.
Yeah. And I think because a lot of assumptions occur with ELL designation. And I think that assumption tends to trend towards certain ethnicities than others. And that's a problem. So let's back up a minute for our listeners and kind of talk about, and I wanted to give the definition of ELL, and I want to differentiate it from what we often hear the term English as a second language, or ESL. So these are the distinctions. So ELL, or an English language learner, is a national origin minority student who is limited English proficient. So this term is often preferred over the limited English proficient, or I think it used to be a term, LEP, as the ELL is supposed to highlight the accomplishments versus the deficit. So we're looking at how proficient is the student in the English language. Now, in terms of, like, when should an IEP team even be, like, thinking, is this a designation or not? This is where the assumptions come in, because, like, if the parents speak a language other than English, if there is a language spoken at home, if the student's first language was not English, generally this is when we should be looking at this. But it's not an automatic thing. It's not like... There's another language at home, another language, the child either, you know, was born having exposure to just one language and that was their first language they spoke. That doesn't automatically mean that they're an ELL student. I think that's where the assumptions come in, because often assessments aren't done. It's just a checking a box.
Yes, that is exactly right. And so then when we're looking at English as a second language, that can be more of an umbrella term for the program that teaches the techniques, the methodology, and, like, at times has a special curriculum, right? That's teaching the ELL students the English language skills. And that is within all areas of listening, speaking, reading, writing, vocabulary, even just culturally, right? As well as study skills. And so then that's where we kind of have those differences. And then this is also not to be, because this has kind of been a new trend lately, especially in Southern California, are those dual immersion programs, which I just wanted to kind of call out really quickly as well. So that is, you know, an entire school and curriculum that is geared towards immersing a child to learn a second language. Right. So that would be Mandarin there, you know, and then more often in SoCal, Spanish. Yeah. So then it's an entire kind of program so that your child starts in kindergarten, and it just depends, but it could be 80% in Spanish and 20% in English. And so then once they get to like third, fourth grade, it's like 50-50. So that is also different than what we are going to focus on today with the ELL.
And I want to point out that a designation of ELL and English second language, they're not mutually exclusive. We have many situations where there is a big demographic population in a school where there are a lot of students who are not native English speakers. And you might see programs where, similar to how like we have RSP, a group of students are pulled out to have this language, this English language instruction that is separate. And that's not necessarily under the guise or under the umbrella of the IEP. That is something that is a demographic of maybe that school or that population. What we're talking about today more aligns with what should be in the IEP. So we've got a student who already qualifies as has an IEP for, you know, one of the 13 eligibility categories, and simultaneously they can be designated as an English language learner. And what we find is, of course, they can impact each other, right? Being not proficient in English can impact communication delays that already exist because of a diagnosis of autism. A diagnosis of autism can also impact the student's ability to comprehend and understand, you know, language instruction. But just because there are situations where students are receiving that ESL, right, that program, where it might not be under an IEP, it might be more of a general program. But when we have a student who has an IEP and we're looking at English as a second language instruction or programming, it is required to still be individualized to that student. And the IEP is supposed to designate how much time the child needs to receive of this instruction weekly. And, you know, just like any other service, right? It should be designated if it's in a group or individual, if it's pulled out of the classroom, if it's pushed into the classroom. So this may look different for a student on an IEP versus not on an IEP.
That's actually a really good point. And I think being able to kind of see, and we will be having a part two where we will be discussing the assessment portion, right? Not necessarily of designating ELL, but like in relation to the IEP. And that is just bringing me towards like what we want to do today is really talk about how an IEP is developed for this child, if that designation is already there or that they're becoming aware of it. Because it could all be happening at the same time too. We would hope ELL would be the designation before the IEP, just based on, you know, where the child is coming from and things like that. But, you know, the first step is really trying to assess like what that child's English language proficiency is, right? And does it affect how, you know, special education services could be administered?
And how does the language proficiency impact that child's ability to learn and in different environments? So just like we would consider a communication delay or a sensory processing issue, we would consider this the same way as how does it impact learning? How does it impact their access to the curriculum? How does it impact their ability to make progress and go from there in terms of developing goals and services? But, you know, where I find more often than not when I have students that have an ELL designation, that's all it is it's a check mark on the IEP. And it's rarer for me to see more of that instruction. And I think, and we'll dive into like these assumptions, because I think what happens is sometimes when a child is exposed through school to a good amount of English, and maybe they are speaking some English, the assumption is, well, if they know some English, and because we're teaching, you know, English language arts, we're teaching English, we don't need to give anything else because we're already doing that. Therefore, we have the assumption that the student can understand English, whereas that's not always the case. And that's kind of a couple of the cases I've had recently where, and this is somewhat of the distinctions that we'll talk about, the two cases that I have had recently have had to deal with students whose primary first language was Chinese Mandarin, English as their second language. And in one case, the student was never designated as an ELL student, even though the primary language spoken at home was Mandarin, the student's first language was Mandarin, But because by the time they got through the school system, they had some proficiency in English, that it was never even considered. Whereas I have another student, it was designated, but nothing came of it. And by the time the case came to me, it was very clear that the student's language proficiency or lack thereof was a huge impact on the child's ability to understand what was happening in the classroom. And instead of that being kind of dove into more, the team blamed everything on this child's autism, and the behaviors that he was having was, you know, solely related to the autism. And they really categorized it as, it's just not a preferred activity for him. When in actuality, the level of understanding he has is not there of the English language. And we'll get into your example in just a second. I want to give an example of like why this is important. Every language has their own nuances, right? And things aren't always translated exactly the way that we would love them to be, right?
Totally.
And so one aspect of Chinese Mandarin that, you know, I've had to come and learn is that there's not really a yes or no answer. So if you're asking a student whose primary language is Chinese Mandarin, and you're asking them a yes or no question, they're not going to respond and answer as yes or no. Even if they know yes or no, like the word in English, if they're, the way they're processing that question, and the way that they're trying to answer it is primarily in Mandarin, because that is their, you know, more proficient language. The way that these types of questions are answered in Chinese Mandarin is of a repetition. So for example, if you're asking the student, like, you know, are you hungry? They might respond with hungry rather than yes, I'm hungry. Because when we look at behaviors of autism, we look at a lot of repetition. Sometimes kids do have repetition of language, and something like a repetition like that might be considered as they're not really understanding the question, and they're not responding, they're not being compliant. But in actuality, like, language-wise, he is. And if you don't understand those nuances, you might think, well, they're not complying, they're not responding, you know. So that's just one example that, like, I've talked through with this IEP team about how we really truly need to understand not only what proficiency this student has with English, but also how we are not only providing them with actual instruction of, this child needs more English instruction, so more maybe like an intensive program being pulled out, but we also need to be mindful of it in writing accommodations. So how the aide is responding to this child, how the aide is asking questions. So maybe not asking yes or no questions to cause confusion, but actually asking maybe multiple choice questions or more open-ended might be more appropriate for that child. Things like that. So like, it's not just, oh, we're going to pull them aside, give them some, you know, more intervention, and then not change anything about how we act with them in the classroom. Like, we really need to be looking at all aspects of the IEP with regards to language, because language impacts everything.
And it should be noted, if your child is not accessing the curriculum because their English language proficiency is very low, that doesn't mean that they are going to qualify for an IEP.
Right.
This is something that I've had to explain. Yeah, I've had to explain. Like, that's why we need to arrange for there to be a bilingual assessor, right? So that the child is assessed in their native language and in their second language. We want to see the strengths and weaknesses, because I have had clients that have their IQ, their true IQ, show up as being average, above average. The evaluation is provided to them in their native language of Spanish, and then it's not so high, right, when it's English. And so that's why it's really important. That's why Amanda was saying, like, when people are assume it is dangerous, because, you know, it could show, you know, that with the English, assuming that's the second language of the child, their IQ could be very low. That could be because of the cultural biases that are within the assessments, that the child didn't really understand the intricacies of it. And that in and of itself, right, is dangerous when we're looking at the supports and services for the child. So that's why it is important for the child to be assessed in their native language. But it doesn't work the other way around, right? Where, like, if your child is, you know, their English is not proficient, then, you know, we want to be able to have them assess in their own language so that we can get a true understanding of what their strengths and weaknesses are. But, you know, they're not going to just automatically qualify for special ed. That's just like not how it works. Like there has to be unique learning challenges there that are presented within the assessment data.
Right. Need to look at the individual, the individual needs of that particular child to really understand, you know, where they're at, where they should be, and like what gaps are there, and not just for eligibility, but, you know, for developing the IEP.
Exactly. And so just as we're finishing up, that was kind of a little bit about, you know, why it was something that we wanted to discuss, because, you know, at first blush, you're like, yeah, of course, it's something that seems really intuitive. Like, yeah, this child, but sometimes I think IEP teams can get really caught up, right, in the child being new, in the parents maybe having, you know, they have difficulty communicating with parents. And so, you know, there is a structure to which we want the schools to follow, but then to also have those conversations. And this is what we talk about all the time, right? Like, let's dig a little deeper, right?
Yeah.
So that we can. And I don't think, but for you kind of asking those questions at IEPs for that particular child that was, you know, repeating back certain things and not necessarily saying yes or no, like, I don't know that those team members would have gotten there, right? It would have just been designated as a behavior, and then they would have been trying to treat something that is culturally innate to him as a behavior and like try to change that. And it just like would not have worked.
Right. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this, but also like important for teams to know is that it is something that I don't think enough school staff understand kind of this designation, because I think it's just so many just go with the flow and like, oh, it's something that we check on the IEP and that's that. And so the reverse of that, sometimes students are designated as ELL when they shouldn't be, or there might be a time where it should be taken off, because realistically, like if we are given proper and appropriate services to a student, we would want them to become more proficient with English. And so like things could change all the time, and it might not be something where they have this designation forever. But going back to like those assumptions, like we've given some assumptions that if the parent comes in speaking English, then we're not even going to ask about their background, and therefore we're going to assume that they're not designated. But on the reverse, sometimes parents come in speaking maybe Spanish or speaking another language, and then assumptions are made that this child also, you know, when sometimes they don't, you know, or there's also the racial bias of, you know, certain ethnicities or names. And then there's the assumption that, oh, maybe this student, of course, was an English language learner when they actually weren't. They've only known English.
Yeah. So if this has been your experience, please message us so that we have any of your like particular questions that we can either discuss in a separate podcast or with our bilingual assessor that we're going to have on, because the more that we're able to kind of see these, not even hypothetical, like these real situations that are happening, the easier it will be to help you guys create a game plan so that you're able to have the vocabulary to speak about it. And yeah, we're really excited for that. So this will drop and then we will record. So yeah, send those messages to us so that we can get those answered. And we hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day.
Bye.
Bye.